Welcome to the Ultimate Aviators Podcast, where we pair a unique guest with an interesting question to help us master our craft and demystify the industry. I'm your host, Johnny Henderson, owner and operator of Harper Aviation, home of the Ultimate Knee Board. Let's get started. Okay, Steve, welcome to the Ultimate Aviators Podcast. I'm excited to have you, and we lined up a good question for you. Obviously, you're a guest that's near and dear to me. We've worked together for a long time. Today, we're going to jump into what makes a good mountain search and rescue team. And you've got a storied background in helping establish a program for Colorado. And then while we're both still in the military, just a general disclaimer that our views are our own and we're not representing the DoD here. But yeah, I'll let you take it from here. Why don't you do like a brief introduction and then we can start some questions related to your expertise.
Oh, okay, great. Well, first off, thanks for having me. I'm honored that you would have an enlisted man come on an aviation website podcast, so that's great. Let's see. I'm Steve Loeffler. I'm retiring in about 5 days, 6 days, something like that. I'll be done with the Army. I served 18 years, 11 months. I've always been a 15 Tango, and I've been guard my entire career, which started October 19th, 2006. I would say I did my first rescue, like hoist rescue, in 2012. We had been back from deployment for about a year, and that's when I did my first actual live person on the end of a hoist at about 12.5. And it was just me and a flight medic. And from that point, I just became obsessed with doing better because that event had a lot of issues. And so I became focused on honing my craft and becoming a better crew chief. I was crew chief on a UH-60 helicopter as well as a maintainer and also on a CH-47.
Yeah.
I'm sure the hookers love.
For sure. And you said 12.5, that's 12,500 feet, which Colorado is pretty unique for what we call our 14ers. We have a bunch of mountain ranges somewhere in the 50s, right, of how many peaks we have over 14,000 feet. And that makes our terrain particularly difficult. And it's not just the altitude, it's also the high angles that we do the hoist rescues for. So,
yeah, 100%.
So how did our program get started? We've got the Colorado Hoist Rescue Team. And again, we're not speaking on behalf of the Army here, but having both participated in it, the organization's unique in that our state is helping rewrite Vietnam era SOPs for how Army helicopters use hoist to rescue people with that equipment. And a hoist is a winch with a hook on the end that lowers off of a helicopter. So I'll let you go from there.
Oh yeah. No. Yeah. It's been wild because when I first started flying back in 2009, I got an introduction to hoist techniques. We have an internal hoist, which means it could boom in and out of the helicopter. You shut the doors and then fly away. And there was the leadership at that time was very risk adverse and did not allow like for you to practice with patients or even like a live person at the end of the hoist. And if they did for some reason allow it, it was at 25 feet, which was just wildly, like it was just it. There was so much turbulence from the rotor wash, it was just a mess. So, it actually was worse doing it that way. So there's two aviation assets in Colorado as far as like National Guard goes with helicopters and rescue. You have the high altitude training site, or the high altitude
Army aviation training site.
Aviation training site. Yeah, I always mess up the HATS logo. I'm sorry, you got the patch up there on your wall too. HATS, and they're phenomenal. Yeah. They teach high altitude flying, power management. They have some amazing like back seaters, front seaters. Their facility is amazing. And they've always just been top tier, like TRADOC school, like just teaching aviators how to fly in high altitude. They also did a lot of search and rescues. And at the time, the Army's SOP, which guided us, was very bare bones. There wasn't a lot of qualification requirements. It's very subjective based on the instructor. And at this time, you get Hats, who's working with some of their search and rescue teams, unofficially. Like, they're just working with them and using them because
civilians. Yep.
Yeah. So civilian search and rescue teams. And we at the time were not. We had no other agencies. We didn't work with any other NGOs or anything like that. We were guard only. You would take a medic with you who didn't have any ability to do medicine in the aircraft.
Or mountaineering.
Yeah, because they were restricted from their protocols. And so kind of fast forward to my event in 2012, I went from Denver, like it was September 7th or 9th. I can't remember which one of those days. It was right around my birthday. And we went up and did this rescue. And I had a flight medic with me. And the climber who we were rescuing fell at this, it was like a little wall. You rappel down about 110 feet and then you walk 5 feet and then you can climb up. And it's probably like a 5.4, which is like a climbing grade. So it like you have the potential to fall, but like 5.4 is pretty easy. However, there is a lot of water, snow, and ice that builds up in these rock crevices. And this person was climbing with ropes and protection, had stuck their gear in, and one of the protection failed when they slipped and fell and hit their head. So we went up there, a flight medic, myself, and two pilots, and we went to go do this rescue. And at the time, we were lowering our medic down on what's called a jungle penetrator. That was a device they used to use to penetrate the canopy of like in Vietnam. And it just was a holdover. They never really innovated any new equipment or brought that into the army. And it's just this giant, you're going to have to throw a link up to what a JP is on your
It kind of looks like a ship's anchor, but kind it collapses.
It collapses and it has a point that's rounded off at the bottom and it's all metal. So, and then these legs fall down and you can clip yourself in with the strap. And so if you imagine taking this piece of metal on the end of a cable about 150, 175 feet down and putting it onto like rock is where we were dropping this medic off, right? So it hits and it's just going everywhere. We have our army boots on. This is when we were wearing the digital ACU pattern. And you just have your regular flight boots on and they have the Vibram soles and no grip. They're not mountaineering boots. They're nothing. They're just army boots. So we put him down on the side of this little, there was a bunch of scree. It was like, kind of like a scree field is how I want to explain it. Little pieces of rock all together. But he went down. He signaled me. I put some cable out and he went to take a step after he got the JP and he slipped. And he went right off the edge of this cliff. And I watched him fall. Until all the slack was out of the cable, then it went taut. He swung out and then swung back and he hit the cliff. And then I watched the JP flip behind his body. He was just hanging on by the strap. His helmet was turned sideways. His mask, he had a maxillofacial face shield, which protects your mouth and your lips and nose and stuff from debris and protect. It just helps you speak easier sometimes. And he lost that. And he was just hanging there. And that was my first ever hoist, like with a person. And I was just like dead quiet. Then I kind of yelled and then I clicked the mic and I was like, hey, Williamson fell. And my pilots were like, what? And then he gave me a thumbs up. We put him back down. And so fast forward, I get him on the ground. He hobbles over and gets with a patient. We fly off, shut down. And then he calls us, okay, we're ready for pickup. So we start back up and fly over there because we were low on fuel and power was kind of weird. Weather was bad, so it made more sense to shut down. I go back, drop the cable down. They hook up this litter. It's coming up. I'm like, oh, my gosh, my first rescue, here's this guy. And it stops about 6 inches below the bottom of the helicopter. Like, so you have your cabin floor, so it comes out. And then here was, like, the top of the litter. And I'm like, what do I do? And I looked up and I was out of the cable was fully retracted. And what had happened is the search and rescue team members had rigged up spider legs from the litter to where the hoist would hook up the pendant. And they were really long. because they didn't know.
Yeah.
So I had to lengthen out my monkey tail, and I just did the dumb thing, and I leaned out over this patient and just picked him up with the pendant in one hand and just kind of boomed it in and just kind of pulled him in on top of me, and my cords shut the door. I was like, yes, let's go. We got him. I'm a hero. I couldn't move because I had put him on top of all my cords and my my monkey tether, or my it's a restraint tether that keeps me from falling out or falling too far out. And I was just stuck in the back looking at this guy. And we went and flew, and we handed him off to the Flight for Life because they just didn't have the ability to get him. And I remember I grabbed, it was some member from Alpine Rescue, and I looked at him in his face. I was like, we have to work together because this isn't okay. And he was like, yeah, let's do it. So HATS was doing their unofficial, like, they didn't have it really standardized work with their agencies. And 2 years of like trying to set up meetings never happened. Like, leadership tried and it just never happened. And I want to say around 2017, I moved up to the front as an instructor instead of a mechanic. And I met a gentleman from North Carolina, Clayton Hornay. He's CW4 now, I believe, and deployed. Mm-hmm. Shots up, fixed wing, go what? But he was a medevac pilot. And he had flown some pretty hairy missions and doing a lot of work with the rescue teams in North Carolina. He really took the ball and just started going. And he was like, hey, are you in on this? And I was like, yeah. I kind of had written a manifesto about equipping our guys with the right stuff, getting them trained up. And it just kind of largely like went unnoticed. So I jumped on with him and we started talking to HATS about what they do. We went up there and myself, Sergeant Bilo, he was another SI I served with in this program. Like, he went up there with, and we kind of watched what did HATS do and how did they integrate their rescue team members. And they had a very established relationship. We were not as trusting because our leadership was way more risk adverse, you know, being a deploying kind of unit and who has medics, like that's a lot. There's a lot of nuance, I think, that in politics and bureaucracy and whatever. Excuse me. So we started building this program, and we called it the Colorado Hoist Rescue Team, and CHRT for short. But we just started building practices that were teachable and repeatable and that protected us and protected the crew. So the search and rescue crew, so that everybody was on the same sheet of music. We didn't have them act as crew members, which was something that HATS was doing at the time, not really acting as crew members, but they were trained in like airspace surveillance, which is one of the main tasks of a crew chief. And I couldn't swallow that pill yet, I think. So we just kind of put a choke chain really tight and held it really close to us until we built that rapport. So it just kind of grew from there, though, and we started doing lots of training, lots of testing, and then we did our first mission with our guys.
That's awesome. I've only done one rescue thus far, but incredible feeling, right? And then you're helping build that program. A couple things stood out to me that catch my attention just like through the filters that I'm used to working in. I'm a systems engineer by trade outside of the Army, and you being part of the standardization portion of aviation, a couple of the buzzwords, right? Systems really helped ingrain whose role is what, and some of those constraints, or I guess maybe not constraints, but boundaries to work within for each of the roles of crew members is really important. And then you talked also about collaborating with HATS as an organization and seeing how they did things and then coming together and defining a program, and then the civilian side of how these people fly in our helicopters and also are a contributing crew member to these rescues. What role have you seen, I guess broadly, standardization in these rescues play? Because they're not easy, right? I mean, you had tons of lessons learned from that one and then went on countless other rescues after that. What role is standardizing those processes and even equipment done for hoist rescues?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the importance of standardizing that when you get into a cockpit, so the major goal was to integrate what we do at the facility, at the Colorado Army Aviation Support Facility in Aurora, Colorado, with HATS, who's located up in the mountains at Gypsum, Colorado. How do we, what if we can't fly that weekend and they have to take a mission on our side of the mountain, right? So draw a line down the mountains and we do one side, they do the other. Would our rescue techs, as we call our search and rescue guys, or rescue techs, be able to get into a HATS aircraft and see the same thing? See the restraint tethers in the same place, the same color coded, looking at, you get in the back and it's like right to left. You're like, oh yeah, it's the same. You look up at the equipment, it's all stowed the same. And having that kind of, that standardization, I think it creates an atmosphere of safety, of comfortability. It doesn't remove, I don't think it builds into complacency at all. It's, but it does provide, like, it's not a foreign environment. And you get into it and you're like, okay, I know what this is. And they know the same calls. We make the same calls. We make everything the same. So you can integrate, and it's just like throwing pieces into whatever you need. So, it was tough because it's, to go back to the kind of standardizing, we have our way of doing things and HATS had their way, and it's not, either wasn't right or wrong, but we were both different. And in that attempt to unify the vision, there was a lot of, we'd give ground, they'd give ground, compromise reigned supreme. Mm-hmm. And then there were some things that they put their foot down on, and we said, okay. And then there was things we put our foot down on. But how do you track who's qualified? How do you track if they're current? There's just no systems for that. There was no process. So we created this whole tracking, training, qualifying, this whole, it was just this mess. It was kind of controlled chaos. It was just, there's documents all over Google Drives and then on the Teams and then back into SharePoint and trying to consolidate all this information between all these entities. But without that, I don't think we would have been as successful as they are right now.
Right. Well, and I think even something as basic as a rental car, right? If you go and get a rental car from somewhere, generally speaking, a lot of the controls are going to be in the same place. And then occasionally you get the car where you're like, why did this company feel like they need to do everything different? I don't know where any of the switches are. Right. And then you take that to aviation and it's even more complex. And the last thing that you need when you hop in an aircraft is unfamiliarity with the systems. You need to be focused on outside the aircraft more than inside the aircraft. And the less you're worried about how things are operated, the more you can focus on your role. And so I think that's a really key component to aviation safety is the standardization. And that's why we use things like checklists and even mm-hmm. maintenance procedures, right? If it's repetitive and it's replicable, that can translate to other organizations. And I think something else that you touched on too is integrating cultures is always super difficult, especially in a field like aviation where it's so type A. It's really hard to be the person that comes to the table and says, I don't know everything, but the needs of the organization and our profession are at the forefront of what we're trying to accomplish here. And let's use that as a filter for everything that we're doing. So,
yeah, agreed. And it was funny because up to the point of us trying to standardize this program and create this entity, it was 80% skill, 20% luck. Every rescue was just okay, you had that little swag of luck, okay, yeah. And you can't operate like that. Statistically speaking, you can't without having incidents. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're just not going to do well if you're just on a wing and a prayer. So being able to to change the culture and say, hey, before we go fly, we're going to read this checklist. That was a thing. Like, that was a thing. I had to sit at a table and be like, we can't take off until we read this. And I'd have pilots who'd be like, I know what I'm doing. I was like, I know you can. You can fly this aircraft. You're amazing. We're going to go through this checklist. We have to do this. Like, and I think it's when you, if, what if there's an incident and you have to go back and you're like, hey, did they brief this? Did they do this? Did they check this? Was this addressed? Well, if you're not using that checklist and you're not following those procedures, then you're opening yourself up to scrutiny and the Monday morning armchair quarterbacks, right? And you're like, oh, well, if I was doing that, I would have done this. But I mean, it's as different as HATS aircraft weigh less than our aircraft do, because our aircraft are all set up to go to war. So they have a lot of like protections, radar systems, just lots of special different stuff. HATS gets to operate with stripped down aircraft that are, don't have all that stuff. So their weight difference, they have a different ability than we do based on like how much fuel we have and, you know, the temperature and winds. Just it's so like you have to blend all that together and an ego. Yeah, it was great. Yeah. It was a very traumatic couple of years of building that program. There's lots of hurt feelings and beers drunk afterwards to talk about or how we can move forward. But I mean, we all came to the table to do the mission. So I think that was the important part. And I think that's what, to answer your question, what makes a successful search and rescue team is an organization of like-minded individuals who will always put the customer at the center and safety right nested in that. So
yeah, that was perfect. Yeah.
I didn't even practice that. That just was off the top. Just go enlisted.
Yeah. You're good at the quips and one-liners through the time that we've worked together. There have been a lot of times where I'm like, oh, I need to write that down. That was good. So. Can you walk through what the training and certification process is like? I think because it's a glamorous job, it garners a lot of attention from outside organizations, which means we really have to have our ducks in a row, because media or state leaders, right? We have leaders that are supportive and enthusiastic about this program, and we want to retain that positive outlook. But then internally, right, we want to both encourage participation, but hold a prestige standard of training and excellence, like you were saying, with the customer at the focus and safety. And part of that is selecting capable crews. And so there's significant train up required to be able to participate because of the margins that we operate. So what were some of the training guidelines that you started working through, and what did that process of participating in the hoist rescue team end up looking like?
Yeah, that's another good question. So you did touch on something that I think is super important. You talk about leadership in the media. Like, that garners this whole other level of like spotlight on what you're doing, good, bad, or indifferent. If you do, you know, you go from hero to zero real quick. And I think the impact that has on training and qualification is that people want to be in that spotlight, you know, have that 15 minutes or that post of like, look at what you did, this awesome rescue, and like a cool video. But what they don't realize is all the work that goes into making it look so effortless. So there's a lot of people who like are looking to cut corners so that they can, you know, kind of be in the limelight. And like, I think we did a really good job in our qualification. We just made it very robust. I mean, I don't think we went overboard by any means. We have, I'm not sure where it's at currently, like to this day. I'm not up to date because I have been managing it for about a year and a half, 2 years. But I can tell you, we had, you know, your initial, like you had to be qualified just as a basic hoist operator through the Army. So that's its own thing. They have this whole procedure. So you go through that, and I'm not going to go through all that, but it's a lot of iterations and emergency procedures and so on and so forth. Then with the CHRT, for the operators and the pilots, you would go through academics. And in the academics, we would talk about all the equipment, we have a bunch of specialized equipment, and that was one of the cool things too. This Able, we had support of our CEO, Colonel Gentle, like 100% backed us and let us go get the equipment we needed, and that would work. And we tested it, and we did hundreds of iterations out in the sod to make this work. And then once we incorporated this in, we wrote it into our SOP on how to use it and when to use it. And then we created the familiarization training where everybody put hands on it. They touched it. They used it. They went out and they did like static in the hangar. You would have to do static iterations with all the equipment. You would have to do static run-ups in the aircraft. Like, we wouldn't have the blades turning at all. We just get everybody on a headset and here's how startup is. Here's what we're going to be saying. Here's the things. Here's how you talk on these headsets to us. And that was before we integrated their external comms into ours. So we were running extra ICS cords and they were plugging in and, you know, we're talking. And they wouldn't know sometimes and start talking over the pilots. And so we had to teach them the etiquette and the terminology. And then you had to teach the crew members how to look out for the guys in the back because they're non-aviators. So now you have this other factor that you have to be aware of as besides everything outside the aircraft. Now you have an inside factor that you have to be. And I wouldn't say it's a threat, but it's just one step here, one miscommunication, one door opening. Oh, I came unhooked and the door opened and oh, there they went. Like, that's not where you want to be when you're at 13,000, 12,000, 10,000. I don't care. 8,000 would suck. Like, and somebody come out of the helicopter, it's no good. So we would do all day iterations after we did the static in the hangar. And we'd get our crane out and pick people up and all the equipment so they know what it felt like. Then we standardized all the hand and arm signals so that the guys on the ground gave the same things to the guys up in the helicopter. And it just like another language. Then we'd go out and do day iterations. And you track all those iterations, make sure they did it. And it wasn't just like, okay, he did it once, he didn't die, he's good. It was, he did it once, now we're going to do it in kind of a faster pace, you know, like a crawl, walk, run kind of methodology. Thank you. And then after they successfully completed that and had kind of melded into the crew, then we'd go into the MVG stuff. And then we would go set up scenarios. You have a lot of pausing, sorry. We'd set up scenarios where we'd go out to our mountain training areas and we'd bring a rescue dummy and a litter. And I'd go hike up the side of some like hill, random hill mountain in the middle of the forest there. And they'd fly over me and lower down the rescue Randy and I'd unhook them and then they'd fly off and target store it. And then I'd call them in and they would have another evaluator up in that helicopter who would just watch how they went through and completed the rescue. And those training events were like one bag of gas, start to finish. We'd give them a call. It was the real deal. Like, it was such great training for everybody. And then they'd come back, and once you did that mission, then you were kind of like, okay, you're good to hook. And then you're on call. And if the call came down and you responded yes, then you got chosen, then you were going. So, but it wasn't like a one or two, three flights. It was six, seven, eight, nine, ten.
Right, yeah. When I think a lot of what you had brought up mimics high performers in every field. There's a lot of visualization. There's a lot of repetition. And at some point, it becomes intuitive because you know what you're doing. And that's really important in high-stress scenarios. I think professional athletes have a lot of pressure on them, but their life isn't on the line usually. And in this case, not only is someone that we're going out to look for and rescue, their life is on the line. Otherwise, we wouldn't have gotten the call. But also, the entire crew and helicopter participating in this mission is then on the line. And we want to bring the crew and helicopter back safe as well and not add to the scenario of we've got someone injured on the side of a mountain.
And we always said that like their emergency is not our emergency. And when you look at the risk versus reward, like you got a helicopter, multi-million-dollar helicopter and four lives, the six lives aboard that. you're going to take the risk to try to help them, but there's, you don't compromise your safety for the person who fell. Like, you have to make those decisions, and yeah, it can wear on you.
Yeah.
But you're right. High performers though have to have some kind of, I want to say it's not muscle memory, cause I don't believe in muscle memory, but it's that second nature. It's like, you've done it so many times mm-hmm. that when something changes, you see that it changed. And you know how to adapt because you've done it so many times, either good or bad, that you've seen all these different scenarios and you're able to take that and just integrate and seamlessly just like make a decision and move forward. And I think that's where the value of having that standard like qualification table and training events, like that's where those come into play, is they give you an opportunity to fail safely and see alternate paths to the objective, which is a safe rescue of that person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think what makes it unique is it's entirely voluntary. And like you said, you're just on call for the weekend. And several air crew members have started saying, yeah, I don't really drink on the weekends anymore, cause I'm always ready in case they have a rescue come through. And I want to be legal to fly, but also fit to fly, both mentally and physically, and showing up prepared to do that, I think is a huge responsibility. And while it is voluntary, right, it does carry a lot of weight to it, knowing that I think some of the common phrases that we hear a lot in CHRT is, you know, 4 hours of my weekend will give someone the rest of their life with their family. And I think that's pretty awesome. Maybe a pivot here, but still relevant. Having been on the search and rescue side of a rescue, what advice would you give to outdoor enthusiasts? Say you have the worst day, right? You did everything right, but a boulder fell and there's no way to mitigate that, and it hits you and you're in need of rescue. What steps should outdoor enthusiasts take to ensure, one, they're taken care of, but should they need rescue, right? Like finding someone on the side of a mountain, even in a bright color, is very difficult. What gear do you recommend, or techniques to be found, would you share?
Yeah, I think I would say always have some kind of tracking system, like a Garmin, something that you can send one of those SOS messages out with. I have like a Garmin inReach. Mm-hmm. They're like that big, and if I need something, I hit this button and it's going to start broadcasting. I know that cell phones now are dialing into satellites so that you can have cell phone usage, but like having that good location is super important. So having that ability to contact search and rescue, telling where whoever you like is important to you, or who's going to care if you're not showing up, where you're going and what your route is, and then not deviating from that. Like if you tell somebody you're going to go to Long's Peak and you're going to go through the keyhole route, don't go through Cable's route, because if you don't show up, people are going to be on the other side of on the keyhole looking for you, going through the go up to Boulder Field, go on the back side there and look, and oh, we can't find him, and you fell on the Cable's route side, which is on the other face. So I think it's important just to have a plan, stick to it, and then always carry a signal mirror. One piece of gear, if you're hiking, like I go outdoors a lot. I go camping, hiking, climbing, all of it. Always have a signal mirror, because if you have somebody out there looking for you, rescue crews, search and rescue guys, anything, and you're flashing that mirror, if you have sun, that is the 100% the best way to be spotted.
It's crazy for miles. Cheap and lightweight it is. And yeah, miles.
It's like such a low impact, high reward piece of equipment. Like you just have it and you're like, oh yeah, I got this. And you start flashing. So, and know how to use it. I mean, you can't just have a mirror and be like, oh, I had a mirror, but nobody saw it. You got to know how to sweep it. But once you get on Google, watch YouTube video, it's super easy.
Yeah.
So I think those three things, I mean, it's funny. A lot of the people we'd go rescue and I shop at REI, so I'm not bagging on people who shop at REI, but they'd go to REI and buy all the, like the mountain colors, the fall colors, like the greens, the blues, the browns, and you don't see anybody. Even if they have a bright red backpack, you don't see them. You will not see them. Yeah.
Yeah, because
we've flown over it,
thousands of feet away, and usually looking at an angle.
Yeah, and we're just trying to find something that doesn't look like it belongs. But I've confused rocks for people. Yeah, it's been crazy. Patches of grass. So.
Yeah, and I think something else that you mentioned too is the apparel, dressing for inclement weather is also important. I mean, there have been several rescues that are, again, outside of your control. You're not controlling for the weather, but you're certainly prepared for those contingencies, and being ready for the elements when you're on the face of a mountain is essential.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, if you're not bringing something, like, you can buy these lightweight bivvies that you can just, if I have one of them in my bag, it's a little bivvy, you just put it on you, keeps you warm. Like, cold at night, it gets cold in the mountains. During the day, it gets cold in the mountains. We were, mm-hmm. That first rescue I did, I had my shirt off in the sun down at Buckley. We got up to the mountains at like 12:05, and I could barely speak over the intercom system because I didn't bring any other cold weather gear. I didn't have my jackets and my stuff I needed because I was like, oh, it's nice here. I didn't think about the effect of altitude and the wind it was freezing. So, I mean, that happens. You get in the shade on the other side of a mountain on like a north-facing side of a route. You can, hypothermia is real. So, you know, they have the five essentials. I'm trying to remember off the top of my head what they are, but like you go to any one of the search and rescue teams or just look online for the five essentials for hiking or camping. It's like a fire, a light. I forget what else, man. It's just like, I have them in a bag. I don't even remember what they are, but like you can look up that list, and those are just basic things you can bring. So
yeah, I'll look it up and throw a link in here. I think maybe one last technical question related to the mountain rescue things that we're working through today, but have you ever had to call off a rescue mission or abort mid-mission? And can you talk to that? Certainly the emotional piece, but also what role crew coordination plays.
Yeah, you know, surprisingly, I have never had to call off. Like, I've been on a crew where we had to call off of one. I've been on missions that we lost power. Power changed. I don't know what happened, but we, you know, get a low rotor RPM and just fall, kind of start falling out of the sky, right? We're getting into hoist. And we'd go kind of gather our thoughts and come back. But I've never had to call off on somebody. I just have been fortunate. Like every rescue where the patient was alive was successful. And then all the recoveries, you know, like we had to pick, you know, people who didn't make it. And we found them and you get them out. But there was one person we went looking for who had expired, and we thought that they were alive. Their family thought they were alive and left, but we found them deceased, and that kind of sucked the day, like the joy out of the day. So, I mean, that's that. I guess, I mean, it comes with the territory. Like, I don't know. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say one thing I think the organization's doing a lot better of is in incorporating our chaplain for emotional support, and then even the some of the other high performance mental stress, helping with stress injuries side of things. And that's like the unseen side of first responders, military, search and rescue is how do you deal with the things that are hard to see? Because we're used to completing the mission, and when you can't do that because the person has already passed away, that takes a toll, even if you're able to recover the body for the family and they're able to put their thoughts to rest and honor that person, it sticks with the crew.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we went on a mission for recovery. It was a search, but it turned into recovery, like, real quick. And while... while we're shut down getting getting it all set up so we can go do this recovery. That person's family happened to be at the search and rescue location, and they didn't know yet, and it wasn't our job to tell them, and we weren't going to tell them. That wasn't like, that wasn't for us to do. And they wanted to come over and have a tour of the helicopter, and we had all seen this tragic ending, but they were all like still optimistic at the time and wanting a tour, and there's little kids and the mom and dad, and they're just all, thanks for getting out there and looking. And we're like, yeah. And you're just like, oh my, like,
yeah, that emotional,
that was
weight.
Something that was horrible, because you just wanted to just give them a hug and say I'm so sorry, but like there's protocols and etiquette, and like he wasn't confirmed, but like he was in about 45 minutes after we had dropped the crew off. But
yeah,
so that's rough. And I think that's something the CHRT is doing well now too, is they constantly evolve. I think when you talked about high performance organizations, one thing they don't do is stay stagnant. You don't find something that works and then just keep doing it and never adapt or integrate other tools or methodologies into your process. You look at it and you review it. We call it murder board at the end of a flight, not an AAR. You're like, here's what we're supposed to do. Here's how it was supposed to go. We did what we were supposed to do, but we did it completely different. Why did we do it different? What worked? What didn't work? Why didn't we have fuel? Why didn't we do this? Why should we have done this? And then you take those and you look at them and you integrate those into your next revision. And Clayton Hornet was like brilliant at keeping those revisions like current, like not even like current as far as like he, like our SOP was current. Like he's like, hey, this is relevant. We're going to talk about this. We're going to integrate it. And then this is the new standard. And, you know, we started a whole, a board between HATS and our facility and the rescue techs and the search and rescue, Colorado search and rescue board. Like we all get together and would sit and hash out all this stuff. And that's what improves an organization, is that constant desire to be better and to look at the things you maybe you did okay, but you could have been better at. So what do you need to do to be better at it? That's how you take that next step. You can be like the Ayers or Mott guys. I mean, those guys, if you haven't heard of Ayers or Mott, like they do rescues, I want to say out in Switzerland. Like,
okay.
They're amazing. And they, you know, their crew chief who lowers the hood, I mean, they have different helicopters, they have different equipment, but still, like we talked to them, we as an organization reached out to them and we would get feedback. We'd send them videos of our rescues and our training and say, here's what we're doing. And, you know, we got a lot of really good feedback, positive and some things to improve. And I think you just have to be willing to look at yourself honestly and let the ego go.
Yeah, I think that says it all and kind of ties a nice bow around everything we've talked about so far. In terms of relating to what you just talked about, I was in a support role for a search and rescue recently, and we just did our after action review, and I brought up like, hey, here's all my notes on everything, and also here are a couple things that I did wrong because I had external pressure from like just stuff at home based off of my schedule that day. It was more than I anticipated on top of trying to run this mission. And then on top of that, I'm like, well, I've done this so many times, and I brought up, I relied on institutional knowledge, and here are two or three things that I missed in supporting the air crew going out on this mission that ultimately was probably negligible, but could have made the difference, like calling ahead for fuel. I didn't project ahead. I got weather for him, but I didn't call the airport saying, hey, we've got a helicopter for a search and rescue. Can you be ready with this much fuel? Here's how much they're going to need. Oh yeah, we got you covered.
Okay, that's cool. Huge and, too. Yeah, that's a huge thing.
And so I brought that up, and I mean, luckily everyone had fuel, right? But if they'd gotten stuck out there and I missed that because I wasn't using the checklist that Hornet and you and some of the others have been critical in implementing feedback on, that was a big, like, hey, I will own this. I deviated from the checklist, and that was a an issue that won't happen again, and no one is too good for that checklist, because it just catches things when, I think about systems, right? Your brain dumping everything onto a page so that you don't have to remember it, even your to-do list, right? If you throw it on paper, all of a sudden you've got way more bandwidth to process other things because you're not subconsciously thinking through all the things you'd need to do still. And so just going through that process, so helpful.
Oh, 100%. And it's funny because I've been on the other end of that. We did a rescue at Challenger Peak, and we needed to get fuel, and nobody had coordinated with Alamosa. And so somebody was like, oh, yeah, we'll call for fuel. And they had to, figure out how to call the fueler at home. And he made a special trip to come out. But it took time, and we were on the ground an extra 45 minutes mm-hmm. not doing our mission because we were waiting for fuel. And that was, that was missed. And it was on the checklist, but it got missed. So, I mean, mm-hmm. there are impacts. So, that's huge that you own it. I think ownership's important, so.
Well, shout out to the Alamosa Airport, because that was the one I did not call this weekend.
Oh, yeah. Man, I've fueled out there so many times. Those guys are great. They'll come out there at random times. I've done NVG rescues, and we're like, hey, can you guys wake up and come fuel us? Because we got to go back and pick this lady up. And okay, you guys.
Yeah. So I think that goes to show how much is involved in a rescue, how many entities there are. We've got flight operations personnel that mm-hmm. can initiate an accident plan if something were to happen to the helicopter. They can coordinate things and get ahead of the rescue. We've got the fuelers, both at the airports, if we're away from home, and then at home, the people that come in on the weekend to make sure that that aircraft is ready to go out on another mission and full of fuel, and especially the maintenance folks that keep the aircraft running and all the gear cleaned and prepared. There's a lot that goes into that, so it's not a one-person show.
Oh, it's not. And you know what? It used to be a four-person show, maybe five. It'd be four crewmen and maybe somebody who could open flight ops. It'd be people trying to get the helicopter ready and out with not enough people, right? And that added so much stress, so much time, and it just increased your emotional baggage, and you just mentally destroyed when you got back because you mm-hmm. you were doing everything. But everybody wanted to be part of it. They're like, oh, no, I want to support. And you're like, well, then show up. And they showed up. And when they showed up, I think that's really spread out and lessened the burden on everybody. And it's brought a light to all the facets of aviation to make that rescue successful. Because it's not just, like you said, the pilots mm-hmm. or the crew chiefs. They go out and do the mission, but they can't launch without flat ops, and they can't get their equipment. They can't get their weather. They need somebody contacting the search and rescue coordinator. So you have your OIC who's managing all the information, getting all their approvals. You got your fuelers. You got your maintenance guys making sure the aircraft are set up so you don't have to configure the aircraft right before you go launch, which was something mm-hmm. we used to set that up all the time. And it was just, steps to efficiency. So that revisionist.
Yeah.
Kind of mindset, I think, is important.
Well, now, because of a lot of the work that you've invested in the program, Steve, I mean, it's leaps and bounds over where it used to be. And now we've even got communication with most, if not all, the helicopters in the state saying, hey, heads up, the Guard has a helicopter in this area doing this thing. And I mean, we watch other helicopter EMS missions go out and let everyone know, hey, here's where we're at and what we're doing. And that coordination's been invaluable and a testament to the culture that you've helped build. So thank you that you were invested enough and that now I can participate. And I think that summarizes a lot of what we were trying to get at today, is not just the technical proficiency, but also how much culture and aircrew coordination and collaboration
100%.
Make an organization. Yeah. So. Well, wrapping up just with a couple of a fun questions. I'll get some quick questions. They don't have to be quick responses, and then we'll conclude with you can plug the things that you've been working on and where people can find you. But on a hoist rescue mission, or search and rescue rather, what is scarier, low visibility or high winds?
High winds. All day.
Yeah.
High winds.
Yeah.
Low vis. Okay, that. You got instruments. Pilots can make decisions and fly away, but
yeah,
high winds. Yeah, it's the predictability is nice, and high winds make it very unpredictable.
I'd agree with that. What is in your What is in your go bag that most people wouldn't expect?
Ooh. What's in my go bag that most people wouldn't? A hammock.
That's a good one. I mean, even in the helicopter, have you spent some nights in the Sikorsky Hotel?
I have. I have, yeah. And I saw the Chinook crew chiefs doing it. They could set up hammocks like super easy in a Chinook. And I was like, I'm gonna figure this out. And I went to the Army Navy surplus and I found this hammock and I got two carabiners. I threw it in a bag and I would clip it up across cabin and everybody else would just be staring at me and I was sleeping. And it was amazing. You're waiting for briefs, you're waiting for weather, you never know what's gonna happen. And not being on the ground is amazing.
Yeah, that's a good answer. Is there a myth about search and rescues that you'd love to debunk?
Yeah, there's a myth that we were rescuing climbers. We rescued fallers.
yeah, that's a bit of a misnomer, the correct terminology there.
No, that's just a joke. I would say a misnomer is that the guard is going to send you a bill. Like the guard is going to go, if they get activated to go do that rescue, like, and search and rescue assets on the ground, you're not getting a bill. So don't be afraid to, there's people who get themselves in positions and are afraid of, oh, I'm going to get billed. You get billed when you hit the button and you contact like a professional agency who that's what their job is. They get paid to do that, but we get paid training hours and that's what they utilize those training hours to go fly these missions. It's not like you're pulling money away from taxpayers. We're still getting training out of it. So I think the misnomer is that just, oh yeah, you're going to get like a $70,000 bill if you're out there enjoying the outdoors and something bad happens to you. I mean, people wearing rock helmets, like doing the right thing, have boulders fall on their head, split their helmets and crushed their head. They were doing every single thing right. Mother Nature don't care.
Yeah.
Mother Nature.
I mean, especially in Colorado, our state park passes also help support rescue agencies. So that is funded by supporting your state parks. And then, like you were saying, right, if you call an ambulance, you are getting a bill for that. But search and rescue is not a individual expense, and that's centralized through Air Force coordination. And that's huge, right? Because, again, like one bad day, one of my favorite experiences is where someone came back. I think he was in the video that you were in, where he came back and said, "You guys saved me. I broke my back, but I was able to walk down the aisle of my wedding that summer with my soon-to-be wife wearing a back brace under my tuxedo, and that's because you guys came and pulled me off of a mountain on my bad day." So
yeah,
it's that feedback loop is awesome, especially when we can hear how someone's hospital recovery goes and know that they made it and we're fighting for you. And that's so awesome. So
yeah, that was my favorite part of it. Getting to see him afterwards and kind of touching base. And,
Yeah. Okay. Last question. If you could do a hoist operation anywhere in the world, just for the view, where would you choose?
Ooh, I'd want to be in the Swiss Alps.
That's a solid answer.
That's 100%. Beautiful over there. It's gorgeous.
I was thinking Niagara Falls, but yeah, the Swiss Alps. That's hard to beat.
Yeah, Niagara Falls. I mean, you could probably go fly over there if you wanted to. I mean, you're a pilot.
True.
You know what I'm saying? Like those mountains, like the views, like just the landscape. Out in the area, like Patagonia, the Swiss Alps, all that stuff is just breathtaking. It's amazing.
Yeah.
The most epic views.
I grew up in Virginia, and my father-in-law always teases me that the Appalachians are beautiful, but they're not mountains because he's in the Rocky Mountains. I'm like, well, I lived in Germany. The Rocky Mountains are nothing compared to the Alps, so if we're always just looking for a bigger mountain, the Alps is a pretty good answer. So,
yeah.
Well, thanks for your time, Steve. This has been awesome. Obviously, we've got a great relationship. We worked together for quite a while, and you've shaped a lot of who I am as a pilot and then also as a National Guardsman, and you're a great friend. So I appreciate you coming on today.
No, I appreciate you having me. This has been great. Hope the listeners get something out of this, and I hope it just continues to grow for you. You keep doing good things, man. You keep going.
It's been fun. And we keep collaborating in your garage. Why don't you tell everyone where they can find you and what you've been up to?
Oh, yeah. Well, I moved out of my garage. So I actually have a 2,500 square foot shop now. And I'm doing CNC woodworking and laser engraving, creating custom gifts for a company called Illuminated Industries. And that's my baby. It's my joy. I love making stuff for people. And you can, if you need something like a plaque, you want a cup laser engraved, you know, I do small stuff for people. I can do big things for people. I do the things that like the big box companies don't want to touch because it's not the volume they want. I do it because it brings me joy. So you can reach out to illuminated.us. That's my website. You come check it out. I'm sure Johnny will have a link put there. If he's a good podcaster, there'll be great links below everything. So
I appreciate it. I'm wearing the hat you made me. You've got some custom apparel that you're wearing now that you've done. So not just plaques and laser engraving, but we're working on challenge coin and even apparel. Oh,
yeah.
So.
Yeah, I do swag, stickers, patches, all sorts of crazy stuff. It pretty much, if you want it done, I pretty much do it. I don't know if that's good or bad, but I like to do everything. So,
well, there's some creative genius there too. I think from the crudest of ideas to the most complete thought out design, you're able to work with most things and make a product that people are happy with. So,
yeah, I try.
Yeah. Okay. So you can Illuminated.us. I'll throw it in there.
Get it.
Thanks for coming on, Steve.
No, thanks for having me. I appreciate you.
Yeah. All right. We'll wrap it there. See ya.
All right, buddy. Bye.
Thanks for joining us on the Ultimate Aviators Podcast. Professionals use professional tools, and you can visit ultimateKneeboard.com for your aviation needs. Additionally, visit harperaviation.com/gifts to find your special aviator something nice. Music was by The Fat Rat. Until next time, clear skies.